and the date was September 11, 2001. For anyone certainly in the United States or perhaps around the world, that is a date that will live in infamy. We know what happened on that date. As I was at the time Bloomberg's public spokesman, I was scheduled to speak at an industry event on the 107th floor of the World Tower of the North Tower of the World Trade Center in New York. 2 months before September 11th, I was scheduled to speak on that day on the 107th floor at 9:20 that morning. I received a phone call before the conference producers and I locked down the conference, which was going to be to an audience of 300 people. A friend of mine named Scott was on the program originally to speak at 3:20 that afternoon. So I had 9:20 a.m. on 9/11. He had 3:20 p.m. on 9/11. He called me and the conference producer 2 months before and said, "Chuck, I have a conflict. I can no longer speak at 3:20 in the afternoon. You have the 9:20 a.m. slot. Due to my conflict, would you mind changing? So you take 3:20 on 9/11, I'll take 9:20. It just so happened I had received a request from another organization for a speaking engagement at that time, and I said, "Oh, good, this resolves a conflict of mine. Scott, we are confirmed. You are speaking on 9/11 at 9:20. I am speaking on 9/11 at 3:20. We're good. We are good." The schedule was completely locked down, went out to the community. 300 people were going to come on 9/11. The night before 9/11, I had said to my wife, and normally I don't give her my location, but I said, "I'm going to be the next day," which was 9/11, "I'm going to be in the World Trade Center. My speaking engagements will be over. I will be home by 7 o'clock. Let's have dinner with the kids." I never do that. I didn't think anything about it. At 9:20 that morning, I was in another hotel giving a speech. The regular conference initiated at the World Trade Center, and at 9:20 that morning, I was interrupted by the conference producer that walked into my speaking engagement, which was in the Lincoln Center neighborhood of New York, to state that something has happened at the World Trade Center. "We don't know exactly all the details, but I'm going to ask you to stop. We're going to take the audience and we're going to turn on the television." Everybody stood up. I stopped talking. We went to the back of the conference room where they set up a TV and they turned in on CNN, and we couldn't believe what we saw.
Welcome to Parenting Teens Today with Jesse LeBeau.
All right. Man, I'm already feel like I'm gleaning the wisdom just before we even started here. Chuck, it's good to see you again. How are you doing?
I'm very well, Jesse. Always great to collaborate with you. Thank you for having me on the show.
Would you mind just sharing with the people watching this real quick where you are right now? Or maybe you got a mysterious location.
No. I'm very happy to. I am in Midtown Manhattan, and there are a lot of hotels, and there is a quiet spot in the middle of Park Avenue for a hotel called the Helmsley Palace. And it was owned many years ago by a woman named Leona Helmsley. And she and her husband owned a whole lot of New York City property. But it just so happened, she's one of those billionaires who felt that the rules didn't apply to her. So she decided that she wasn't going to pay her taxes. The IRS wasn't crazy about that. And what I can say now, this hotel that I'm in used to be called the Helmsley Palace, and when she didn't pay her debts or her bills and she was thrown into jail, they removed her name from the hotel. So I am just in the palace.
Just in the palace.
Palace. We will disassociate ourselves from tax evaders. So it's a hotel right in the middle, in the heart of New York. I've come to appreciate it. Always a nice quiet spot if I'm in transit. So it's a good spot. Whatever the history is, they've been very good to me, and for that I'm grateful.
Yeah, so this is a regular spot. This isn't the every year the day after tax day.
Right. No, that's just a coincidence. That came from the hand of God.
Beautiful. Well, I just absolutely think you have an incredible story, as I think everyone is going to agree when they hear it. And I want people to know a little bit more about you in the book that you have out right now. And I would love for you to share what kind of brought you to write this book. And I think that will lead us to other places in this conversation.
You bet. The name of the book is The Moment That Defines Your Life. And there's a couple key words that I wanted to include in the title, moment and define. And I state that for context. This is my second book. My first book was called A Climb to the Top. And it uses mountaineering as a metaphor for how to climb careers. But instead of an ice axe and crampons, the tools that we use when we are ascending a mountain, it's using the communication skills that I used over the many years when I was the public spokesman for some of these Wall Street titans, mostly with Mike Bloomberg. And I learned a lot in that position where I was constantly on stage around the world communicating with people. So I knew when I started my own coaching business many years ago, that was a book that I wanted to write. As I was teaching people, a lot of executives, the tactical considerations of how to communicate, something wasn't right on a couple of the people that I was coaching. And at first, I couldn't figure out why. I thought it was going to be easy. Use the rhetorical techniques that I'm teaching you, which include the simplification of the message, the power of emotional appeal, and yet some people were not grasping on or performing up to what I thought they could. What came to figure out, Jesse, I'm not teaching them just to speak. I'm actually teaching them that maybe for the first time in their lives, they're facing their fears. Fear of failure, fear of making a mistake, fear of judgment, because when you're in the realm of communicating to people, we're always making mistakes. And for people that are afraid to make mistakes, they often miscommunicate and are misinterpreted because they're speaking from a very fearful position. And I state that because as my coaching business was continuing to ascend, I was beginning to think, if I only wrote A Climb to the Top, something is missing. What is it? And what I found, it was the emotional element of what happens to people when they are under stress, they are under duress, or they are climbing a proverbial mountain. Something that is exceedingly scary, but incredibly exhilarating if you get it right. With me so far?
Yes.
All right, and here's where it began to change.
Okay.
As I was considering, how much more or in what other methods can I help my clients? I need to fill this gap. I already have the technical component, but I'm missing how to address the emotional component of the people I'm trying to help. So where does this emotion come from and how do I best deal with it? And then I thought about myself. Well, I need to get inside myself. If I'm going to get inside them, I need to find relatable things that I can do to teach them to face that fear. And as I was considering what could I possibly write that helped them, I gave thought to my past. And what I thought about, Jesse, is all the things I learned in school, nothing was more important as what I learned about myself. And I could figure out whatever that is, that's what the book is going to be about. So let me paint a scene here. And to our listeners, I want to take you back in time. And the date was September 11th, 2001. For anyone certainly in the United States or perhaps around the world, that is a date that will live in infamy. We know what happened on that date. As I was at the time Bloomberg's public spokesman, I was scheduled to speak at an industry event on the 107th floor of the World Tower of the North Tower of the World Trade Center in New York. 2 months before September 11th, I was scheduled to speak on that day on the 107th floor at 9:20 that morning. I received a phone call before the conference producers and I locked down the conference, which was going to be to an audience of 300 people. A friend of mine named Scott was on the program originally to speak at 3:20 that afternoon. So I had 9:20 a.m. on 9/11. He had 3:20 p.m. on 9/11. He called me and the conference producer 2 months before and said, Chuck, I have a conflict. I can no longer speak at 3:20 in the afternoon. You have the 9:20 a.m. slot. Due to my conflict, would you mind changing? So you take 3:20 on 9/11, I'll take 9:20. It just so happened I had received a request from another organization for a speaking engagement at that time, and I said, oh, good, this resolves a conflict of mine. Scott, we are confirmed. You are speaking on 9/11 at 9:20. I am speaking on 9/11 at 3:20. We're good. We are good. The schedule was completely locked down, went out to the community. 300 people were going to come on 9/11. The night before 9/11, I had said to my wife, and normally I don't give her my location, but I said, I'm going to be, the next day, which was 9/11, I'm going to be in the World Trade Center. My speaking engagements will be over. I will be home by 7 o'clock. Let's have dinner with the kids. I never do that. I didn't think anything about it. At 9:20 that morning, I was in another hotel giving a speech. The regular conference initiated at the World Trade Center, and at 9:20 that morning, I was interrupted by the conference producer that walked into my speaking engagement, which was in the Lincoln Center neighborhood of New York, to state that something has happened at the World Trade Center. We don't know exactly all the details, but I'm going to ask you to stop. We're going to take the audience and we're going to turn on the television. We then, everybody stood up. I stopped talking. We went to the back of the conference room where they set up a TV and they turned in on CNN, and we couldn't believe what we saw. Immediately in my mind, as I saw the World Trade Center burning, the first thing I thought of, oh my God, my wife thinks I'm there. No worries, I'm going to call her. The cell phones were dead. The landlines were dead. My next thought, oh my God, there is a calendar on Bloomberg for their entire company to see. I was conscious that what I put in the calendar entry at World Trade Center until 6 p.m. I did not enter into the calendar what time I was expected to enter the World Trade Center. Now I'm in a panic. I can't call home. The internet is out. My wife surely thinks I'm dead. My company probably thinks I'm dead, but I don't know that. We're completely out of touch. When we finally figured out, oh my God, there's complete chaos in the streets. Okay, I was a subway ride away from my office. The New York City police shut the subways down. New York was in lockdown. And it was a good 30-minute walk to the office. So I walk out of that hotel, I look up into the sky, and what do I see? Smoke billowing everywhere. Everyone who was on the street stopped, started looking up and pointing. What the heck is going on? I finally walked to the Bloomberg office, and I walked into the building, met by a colleague who looked at me and said, oh my God, Chuck, everyone thinks you're dead. When everyone was being accounted for, there were four people, and you were one of them that was unaccounted for. I then went up to the elevator where a bunch of the leaders of the company were waiting. They saw me completely in shock. They took out a piece of paper, and there were four names on the unaccounted and presumed dead list. They scratched my name off. The other three had sent a text from the 107th floor saying they were trapped above the fire and they were never heard from again. So, what happened that day? It was not my day, Jesse, to die. And as I thought about that, through a simple twist of fate of my friend, who was an investment banker in another company, that could not speak in the afternoon, simply by his request, that simple twist of fate put me in a different location at the time that everyone thought I was in the building. There was no question in my mind, there has to be a meaning in this because I'm still here. My wife thought I was dead. The kids came home from school. We haven't heard from Daddy. She was very careful to tell them, we think he's dead. She didn't want to panic him. My brothers had called into Bloomberg when the phone lines were up. Everybody knew I was speaking there, trying to find me. So let me stop there just to sit on the weight of that moment and kick it back to you.
I can't even imagine. And at what point in this series of events did your wife find out that you were okay?
It was a very odd thing. The phones never came up, but somehow the internet was up for only a couple of minutes. A neighbor of mine had sent me an email saying, Chuck, I'm taking a pot shot here. Fran tells me you were in the World Trade Center. She had no expectation. I thought I'd try it. Are you okay? Do you read this? I responded, her name is Patty. Hi, Patty. Fortunately, although the phones are dead, I am fine. She lived five houses down from us. Please go home and tell Fran and the kids that I am fine. I will make my way home. I was not in the building in spite of what everybody thought. I am okay. I will see you guys tonight. Please tell her. I can only imagine that within a minute she went running out of the house and she went home, because by the time the phones finally came up several hours later, I called home. They had suspended all the trains. The trains came back. New York was back to normal at around 4 o'clock that day, and I made it home that night. But I can say, Jesse, I went home thinking, what do I do with this? As tragic as it was, for the 16 funerals that I attended over the next month, all I kept thinking about, I had been reading a book called Man's Search for Meaning at around that time, written by a gentleman named Viktor Frankl, who was a Holocaust survivor at Auschwitz. He lost his mother, he lost his parents, he lost his wife, his children. And what he talked about is, when we can no longer change a circumstance, the only thing we're capable of changing is ourselves. And he talked about how he responded to the tragedy of what he was living in. And that was in my head. I knew there was nothing I could do to bring my three Bloomberg friends back to life, all the other people. I couldn't change anything about that day. But there was one thing I could change, and that's myself. And as I read this book, Man's Search for Meaning, I was constantly questioned, is there a meaning? There has to be a meaning in this for me. Why was it not my day to die? So that made a very short story quite long. I think the most important thing that I can say, that several years later, even backing up, it was through the many weeks of New York trying to navigate what the heck happened, who's alive, who's dead. 2,996 people died that day, and I was not one of them. So I said, if I can't change the world, I can't change the event, and I can change myself. Something was brewing in the back of my mind. How do I change myself, and what do I do with the change? So I'll cut through a lot of the thoughts, but on 9/11/2002, 1 year later on the anniversary, I stood on the summit of Mount Rainier. That is the tallest mountain in the contiguous 48 of the United States. And I said, I'm going to climb a mountain, but when you climb a mountain and you reach the summit, there's a book that you register your name in. I didn't register my name. I wrote three names, Bill, Peter, and Paul. They were the three 24-year-olds at Bloomberg that asked to be in the building because of the speech that I was going to give. They passed away when the buildings collapsed. I wanted to do something to honor the spirit of them and the other thousands of people that had died that day. And I can't tell you why it was necessarily on a mountain, other than I just needed to get away from New York and find clarity, get away from my family, my friends. I just needed to be in my own head. And then I figured it out, Jesse. I then stood on the summit of Mount Kilimanjaro. I then climbed the Matterhorn. I then climbed in the Andes. Now I'm climbing, and I had to ask myself, am I looking to find myself? Am I looking to lose myself? What is it? What is the catalyst of doing something so foreign to me that is now becoming a part of me? And in 2012, on a mountain in Alaska, it finally happened. These wonderful guides had taken me up this treacherous mountain in Alaska. And I was so in awe of their competence, of their emotional intelligence, of their inspiration, the way they taught me. I said, I've never been taught like this. What do we have here? And when I came down from that mountain, Jesse, I got it. I am going to go home right now. I'm going to leave this big Wall Street job that I have. For $600, I formed an LLC. I formed my own company. I am now, from this day forward, going to go to work in the service of other people's success. I'm going to take the things that I became very good at, and I'm going to help other people be better than me. So, Klein Leadership, my executive coaching company, was found. Little did I know, Columbia University comes knocking on my door. I'm now teaching graduate engineers and scientists how to communicate and the social science of emotional intelligence. Jesse, I don't know why all of that happened, but what I can say, the exhilaration and the freedom that I felt 9 years ago when I could dedicate myself to teaching other people, short of raising my children, is the most fulfilling thing I've done. And all I keep thinking about is the Mark Twain quote, the two most important days of your life are the day you are born and the day you find out why. On that day, Jesse, I write balloons. I found out why. I said, oh my God, I know why I'm here. And I am going to be intent to ensure that every day I am going to live up to the, and honor the spirit of the people, the places, the things that put me here. And that moment, one of the moments that defined my life.
I feel like I gotta let it sink in, like you said earlier. Man, it's just amazing. And this is something when we talk with kids and parents and families, where you think you're at rock bottom, right? You think you're going through something tough. Well, there's always a little bit more room for an even lower rock bottom. And that's something that I'm so passionate about, is helping people go from I'm someone who needs help to I'm someone that helps others. Right. And there were so many things that just stood out to me. But the one going along that topic there is, you said, there is nothing more fulfilling than going and teaching and helping other people. And I just think that is so powerful, because you've led this incredible career, multiple careers at this point, but the ones that people are thinking, oh, this is, you made it, you're in the most elite companies and you're very humble and you didn't list all of them, but I know the list of all these huge, huge people that you worked for and were representing, and Bloomberg is a huge name. But to say, hey, all that's great, I'm thankful for that, but now I'm gonna serve something that is greater than myself, that's giving back to these people that are in kind of the most exciting stage of their life, right? They're picking, all right, I'm gonna run out and change the world with the thing that I'm passionate about. So I just think it is so beautiful, man, that because there's a lot of people that could go through this exact same experience and they become an alcoholic or riddled with guilt or anger. I don't know how you couldn't, To be honest, you'd be perfectly fair and normal. And the fact that you are able to do this and come here with a smile on your face, I know that there was some dark, dark, hard times that you had to work through, especially switching times and being like, well, is it my fault? And we do that. We all do that. Even though everyone in, that looks at the situation knows it was not your fault. You did not do anything. You can't help. But it's anytime someone gets in a car accident, anytime someone, and someone's like, well, what if I drove them? Or what if I gave them a hug for 30 seconds longer and they would have missed hitting the other car and all these things. So I just want to take a second to acknowledge you. And I appreciate you using this hard time as a superpower to help other people. Because that's really what I see it is that you have. You have the superpower because people go through difficult things, but something on this magnitude and this level really puts other people's things into perspective of like, okay, my thing's difficult, but it could be worse.
That's I'm so glad you said that, because there's something that I didn't write in the book that I think is an important interjection that will lead me to my approach to the book.
Yeah.
On that day when the phones came back up on 9/11, everyone was calling around and checking in. My brothers called in, hey, is Chuck okay? And somebody picked up the phone and they told my brothers and said, all right, no, it's all good. Tell Chuck to call me back later. One of the guys that called in was my college roommate. His name is Doug. And Doug and I had known each other since we were 11 years old. And Doug called me, he had found out I was okay. He heard from someone else. And he said to me, he said, Chuck, how are you gonna deal with the survivor's guilt? And it was a term I hadn't heard before, survivor's guilt. While I didn't know exactly what that meant, I was, okay, I think I can figure it out, survivor's guilt. Am I feeling guilty for surviving? And he said, Chuck, you should see a therapist. And Bloomberg, the next day, brought in a stable of therapists for people to talk to, because everyone was freaked out. And when I went to the therapist, and I wasn't feeling guilty. I didn't do it. Blame the terrorists. I just was not there. But that doesn't mean that I put the guilt on me. To the contrary, Jesse, in fact, I looked at it as a complete opposite. Instead of sitting around feeling guilty, I'm going to use this as an opportunity for reflection to think maybe there is a reason. And if I get lost in the guilt or in the anxiety that somehow I should blame myself, I'm diminishing my only capacity to change myself. And while I didn't know how to change myself, this was a massive journey of self-discovery. And I think as we talk to the kids, and I have four children, and I watch them go through their teenage years, what I said to my kids when I wrote the book, and my oldest one called and he said, Dad, oh, I really like your book, blah, blah, but what I said to my kids is, guys, for all the pressure you put on yourself in school, what I can conclude, I learned more. Anything I learned in school, and I said to them, anything you learn in school will never be as important as what you learn about yourself. And it's only because when we learn about ourselves do we have the ability to determine and figure out how we can help others learn about themselves. Because, Jesse, all of us have been caught in this educational model where success is determined by your capacity to cram, exam, regurgitate, get into an Ivy League school, you've got a path to prosperity. But what that doesn't suggest is your mental health, your capacity to stay calm under the weight of pressure and expectations. Who's teaching our children that? My Columbia students come into my class, they're biting their nails and pulling their hair out because they're so stressed out. And I said, what are you all so stressed about? The grades, the SAT scores. And I have everybody just take a deep breath. And I said, oh my God, what are we doing to you guys? And I tell them the first day of class, never be afraid to make a mistake, but be afraid of not learning from them. If you can get that right, it's okay. And it's okay not to be okay. And it's okay to have bad days. And you're not always going to get an A. But what I want out of this class with me, I don't give a damn what you can regurgitate to me. I don't care, and I'm not impressed. That doesn't make you unique. And I stopped giving exams. Everybody gets 100. Whatever. What I'd rather you do, come up in presentation mode and tell me what you learned about yourself, your self-awareness, your social awareness. And so, Jesse, I want to make that slight interlude here, because the moment that defines your life, when I figured out, what am I going to write about? Well, people associate me to two things, two domains, public speaking and emotional intelligence. And I've practiced emotional intelligence because through the course of my coaching practice, it's what I needed to help get inside my clients. And think about that, emotional intelligence, the human side of intelligence. There are a lot of books on emotional intelligence. But what I learned through the years, I learned this philosophy, this ancient philosophy promulgated by the Roman Emperor Marcus Aurelius, called Stoicism. And Stoicism is not looking at events and not feeling them. It's looking at circumstances and events and developing the mindset that I cannot control those external events, but I can control how I choose to react, respond, and signify that event. And your question about 9/11 and you weren't feeling guilty or you didn't blame yourself, that's the Stoic. I didn't do it. I didn't control it. There's one thing I can. That's my mind. So I control the mind, and I can teach others to control the mind. And if I can do that, what I did, Jesse, in the book, I juxtaposed this ancient philosophy of Stoicism with the social science of emotional intelligence, bringing both of them and integrating the best of them as a toolkit for how do you think about the events, how do you respond to those events, how do you act and react under the pressure and expectations of others, not trying to control them, but only the capacity to control myself.
I love it, man. You saw me getting excited. Oh my gosh. So this was imparted to me from my father through sports growing up. And it boils down to three words. And I feel like I hear these three words with almost every conversation I have, whatever religion, whatever doctrine. And it comes down to attitude is everything. And I feel like as you were saying that, I'm like, oh, that's just another way of saying it's your attitude. You can't control what's going on around you most of the time. And unfortunately, some tough things are going to happen, but you can always control how you choose to respond with your attitude. And that's our program is the Attitude Advantage Program. We have the word in there, and that's something we talk to all the parents and we work with all the kids. So I'm totally on board with this message. So between the attitude, and then another one that a close friend of mine, Dr. Elizabeth Lombardo, shares is the red zone. And so she explains it like this. The psychological red zone, not the football red zone, but the psychological red zone is when you're in an elevated state of stress, anxiety, anger, whatever that is. And out of a 1 to 10 scale, you're on a 7 or above. This is where you tend to make bad decisions. You say things you regret, you eat foods and substances in and out of your body. So her recommendation is don't let anything in or out of your mouth when you're a 7 or 10 or higher. And also at the same time, come up with some coping mechanisms. Is it, hey, I'm in the red zone, I need to go for a walk, I need to throw in the AirPods and listen to some music, I need to take a stroll, whatever the thing is, right? And I feel like that is kind of along the lines of what you're saying of, man, it doesn't mean I don't feel this. It doesn't mean I'm not irritated at my kid if I'm a parent, or I'm not irritated at my parent if I'm a kid, but it's like, what do I do? And I feel like this is something I've only begun to somewhat in a small percentage understand in the last few years of my life. And I feel it and I'm like, okay, yep, I wanna get loud and I wanna say things that I shouldn't say. And I still do sometimes, but I've gotten better. And maybe that's just a little bit of maturing, But I like to think that if I had never learned about this, that I would still be going around and I wouldn't really be the person steering my own ship. All these outside external factors a lot of times take control of you if you let them. So to kind of bring this full circle, how would you recommend or impart parents be able to teach their kids how to be more emotionally intelligent and embrace stoicism and really just regulate their emotions and anger and all that? Because that's a difficult thing.
It is, but I do want to, and I really like the sports analogy you brought in. And before I advise the parents on what I said to my children, what I would recommend, because American growing up sports is a big deal. Even if none of my children were going to be athletes, but they all played sports as most kids do. I'm not a huge sports fan, but I do admire immensely tennis. Just because I see these gladiators out on the court all by themselves, their offense and their defense. And I particularly like Rafael Nadal. And what Nadal talks about, and what I've heard him speak often, he said, all those people that I play tennis, they're just as good as me at tennis. I'm no better than any of them, including Djokovic and Federer and everyone else. But he said, you know what I do? You know what the reason is that I win a lot of the times? What I do on the court, and he calls it a battle, I battle the negative thoughts in my head. That's what I do. And every 20 seconds, the 20 seconds between the time I lose a point and the time that I actually have to serve the ball, I have a choice. What am I going to do? And am I going to let those 20 seconds defeat me? Or am I going to let those 20 seconds define me? Which is why I called the book The Moment That Defines Your Life. When you referenced before, some people, it defeats their life. So think about, heighten the contrast between define and defeat. What does Rafael Nadal say? Well, what I've seen our parents do, or many parents do with their kids, it's all about technical competence. How you swing the bat, swing the bat. Okay, I get that. But who's teaching our children about battling the negative thoughts in our head when moms and dads are screaming at their kids to get a single and bring Billy home when you're going to get out 7 out of 10 times? So I'm stating that as a matter of passion and conviction. And I'm not suggesting that the parents don't care. What I am suggesting is sometimes their overemphasis on the technical aspect of a sport, of school, of a subject matter is overweighted. If your child gets an 89 because they had a bad day, for God's sakes, forgive them because they were not okay that day. They're going to get a 95 the next time. Maybe it wasn't their day. But what I learned, Jesse, from my dad, who was a college professor, he said, all I ever expect from you, Chuck, is to give me your best that day. Sometimes your best is 100 and sometimes it's an 80, but if you play the percentages, you're going to be just fine. And that's my suggestion to the parents. The educational model is drilling into our children. It's rewarding what they get right and it punishes them for what they get wrong. But where is the space to allow them the emotional regulation when they are being criticized under the weight of enormous pressure? What I'm suggesting is we are not teaching our children coping mechanisms. And part of what I teach my children and my students is a coping mechanism. And I'll give you one example. If you are in an interaction, and what happens in interaction when the heart starts to beat, we tend to speak a lot and we tend to speak very fast. So what the mindset of stoicism does, that it's mindful in the interaction, I'm going to slow it down just as I'm speaking right now. And there's a coping mechanism called stop talking, start counting. So as you're speaking, and if you're mindful of that trigger, you will shut your mouth no matter what you want to say, stop talking. What do? You can even, if you have to activate this mechanism through body language, hold up a 1, 2, count to yourself silently, 3. You've just given yourself 3 seconds for space. You can't get into any more trouble because you haven't said anything. So keep your mouth shut. If you haven't diffused the interaction, go to 4, 5, 6, put your hands down or put them in the prayer position to indicate the visual element of the person that you're getting into something. They're seeing that you are putting your heart and your hands together, and that's a peaceful place. You are showing intention about your desire to diffuse this thing. I don't want to keep fighting. All I want to do is for us to find something in the middle where we can both calm down. And you don't have to be religious to be in the prayer position, because we all universally recognize it as a place of peace. So what I recommend and what I wrote in the moment are prescriptions for what happens when we as human beings get ourselves into a behavioral jam, which happens all the time. It is okay to disagree. It is okay to be angry. That's a perfectly natural human inclination. It is not okay to act like a jerk because you're under that kind of pressure. So the interesting part, Jesse, you can be angry and you can be frustrated, but you can do it with respect. Who knew? Is possible, but it's not what schools teaching our children. So by the time some of my students come into my classroom, it's anxiety and stress. Okay, you got into a great school, good for you. But if you're not happy, what's the point?
Yeah.
And so, Jesse, I hope and I really admire and appreciate the work you do in the service of, it's brutal being a teenager in this country these days. Oh my God, those poor seniors in high school, they apply to 30 colleges, they can't afford any of them. They're made to feel like losers if they don't get in the right one. The self-esteem just keeps getting whittled, and what are we doing? Deep breath. Just recognize we're all each other's teachers. We're not gonna get everything right. And if you don't get into Harvard, maybe you can take a whack at graduate school, but you know what? The Ivies don't have a monopoly on success, and I'm the exact, I didn't get into an Ivy. My SATs were so embarrassing. They said, don't even bother to apply. You know what? Oh, good. I'll figure out a way to succeed without you people. And that was my attitude at the time. But I just want the parents to recognize there are other things you can teach your children. And it's the small behavioral actions and reactions that is what people talk about when they talk about your kids. They're not always talking, oh, he's so smart, he's so intelligent, he's well behaved, he's a pleasure to have in class, she's always smiling, she sits at the front, she's got a great attitude. That, Jesse, is the conversation that I want when people talk about my kids. That is more important to me than, hey, your kid got a 99 on the exam. Okay, well, probably 20 other kids did as well, so that doesn't make me feel any better.
Yeah. And those things make you really stand out. When a kid can shake your hand and look you in the eye and be confident in themselves and own that space and have a personality, it's exceptional. And I feel like less and less kids are able to do that today because of screens and phones and the way the world is, that when someone does do it, it's like, wow, this is really, really exceptional. So, man, I love that. And I feel like I'm guilty in my own life of always looking to the next thing, whether it would be an Ivy League school. For me, it was a lot of basketball and career driven, right? And as I have more conversations, it's like, hey, if you can't enjoy right now this conversation with Chuck, then you're missing the boat, because it doesn't get any better than this. Yes, more money and success can come, but life gets infinitely more complicated. And so you have to enjoy these moments right now.
Well, and also to the parents and to the children who may be listening, many of the athletes have mindset coaches. My friend, I don't coach athletes, I coach executives, but it's very similar. It's not that different what we do. What do we not do? We do not sit around focused on outcomes. That's insanity, because you're not focusing on the thing in front of you. When you have a baseball player get up to the plate, he can't be thinking about, oh, I'm gonna get home in another 20 seconds. He has to think about what he's gonna do with the pitch. Because if you don't know what to do with the pitch, you're never gonna hit it out anyway. And I think for all of us, I believe it's my humble opinion Society is too focused on the outcomes. Well, what do we want? How are we going to get there? No, what most people don't answer the question, how are we going to get there? They just want to get there, and they think about getting there. Uh-uh. What I talk about in the book is what the Stoics do. Never focus on outcome. You know what it is. Everybody knows what they want. Usually they do. Focus on the inputs. What's my next step? What's my next step? That's me, the mountaineer. We never talk about the summit. What we talk about is what are the small steps, the milestones that we have to get? So if we have an 18,000-foot mountain, we start at 6,000. The only thing we're focused on, how do we get to 7? And when we get to 7, we'll get to 8. Small increments, small steps, little bit at a time, because there's so much in front of us we cannot predict, especially the weather. And taking the mountain metaphor out, it's no different. All these things happen. Oh, that wasn't supposed to be there. That wasn't supposed to happen. Well, God laughs when we're busy making plans.
It's a great analogy. How many mountains, out of curiosity, have you gone up at this point?
I've probably climbed 50 or 60 mountains, but 8 major expeditions. 8 where we were gone, out of touch, out of, and they include Mount Bona in Alaska, Kilimanjaro, the Matterhorn, a lot of mountains in the Andes, Mount Elbrus in Russia, which is in the Caucasus Mountains. That was the epilogue of my book, an episode that happened on that mountain. That is how I finished the book, and it was another life-defining moment. It was the bookend to what happened on 9/11. An incident occurred on the Caucasus Mountains at 17,000 feet above sea level. I'll leave it out for now, just in deference to time, but it was an incredible moment on the mountain. So the two moments that changed my life, one of them was before I got on the mountains, and one of them happened on a mountain in Mount Elbrus in the Caucasus. And I explain in the epilogue, which really brings the whole matter of what started me thinking about finding meaning in my life, all of that led to an unexpected moment that was a tremendous revelation in my emotional intelligence development because of an incident that occurred with one of my guides when I fell off the mountain at 17,000 feet and I was sliding down and I had to self-arrest. I'll leave that cliffhanger out there if anybody reads the moment that defines your life. But Jesse, that mountain, I think why I am so joyful and so fortunate to have found the mountains, it's the perfect metaphor for me to be the mountain guide for people from what I learned about becoming a mountaineer. I feel like that was my fate. And that's where whatever gods may be led me to that place. And I think everyone has it in them. If we open up our mind to the fact that you can do something that isn't necessarily up to someone else's expectations, that if you have the agency and the courage to make up your own mind about what makes you happy, I never want to dismiss parental expectations because I see all of that. But I think when you become an adult, we want 3 things. We want agency. We want that autonomy. We want a sense of belonging. And we want to feel like we are doing something for a cause. That's called the ABCs of life out of a book called Life is in the Transitions. Let me repeat that. What do we want? Agency, belonging, and cause. And if you can find the intersection in that Venn diagram, which I did, I have climbed to that intersection. It didn't just happen. I had to get there. I didn't know how to get there. So my mountaineering journey became this expedition of discovery, of self-examination that led me. And I think if that hadn't happened, I certainly wouldn't have felt as fulfilled and free as I do. I needed that. And I think it needed me. We came together for me to be able to make a difference in other people's lives because I want them to make a difference in other people's lives. So if I can pass them the torch and they can pass the torch, why the hell else are we here? That's what happened.
Boom, mic drop.
It was just, we're you know, just lucky.
I think everyone listening to this, you naturally think about your life when you start talking about these things, right? Your story, it's like, oh, I've experienced that, or that here was a defining moment for me. And one of the ones that I share when I go talk is what happened in seventh grade with a bully in this incident regarding basketball. And basically this older, bigger, stronger kid telling me that I wasn't going to be able to do basketball, that I was going to ride ponies for a living. And I don't think he would even remember that story happened, other than lots of people have told him, they heard the story. So he knows about it now, but I don't think he probably remembered it. But to me, it was such a profound thing because it was a defining moment, because I could listen to him. And it wasn't just listening to him, it was listening to all the other people in my life thus far and after that who told me the exact same thing. Basically, I wasn't enough and I didn't have what it takes and all these things that people experience when they experience a bully. But if I would have done that, I would have never got to experience life to the fullest on my terms, doing the things that I loved. And I think, honestly, as a seventh grader, it was just kind of my personality was to be like, you're not going to tell me what to do. I'll show you. Kind of like you I'm not going to Ivy League school, but watch, I'm still going to make something of my life. Even though these SAT scores aren't the best, I can make up for it in some other areas. So
isn't that funny, though? We remember the funny. It's funny in that it's an interesting observation. I was bullied as a kid, too, because I was an obese kid. I'll never forget at 13, the worst bully in, and the bully probably doesn't remember, but Jesse, we never forget those moments. And I think you and I, mainly, they became our best teachers. Those moments helped us to see opportunity when to many other children, sadly, it does defeat them. And maybe we were just fortunate enough that our nature said, I can't let it defeat me. The stakes are too high. And we were strong enough to let it define us. For all the children, sadly, that I see that it defeats them, I want them to know from our perspective, it's okay. That bully, you know what? Kill him with kindness, as hard as it is. I wish I had learned that. Instead of fighting back, I should have walked away, but it's easy to say that in retrospect. But for anyone, I feel their pain, and we're here to help. And we understand, we relate, we know what you're feeling. Don't go it alone, don't bottle it up. And journaling it, yeah, it's okay, but call us. We get it, we feel you. And I think we need more of that.
I got one final question for you. Well, technically two, but one I'm going to say is the final question, okay?
Sure.
If you were going to go back and you were about to start your parenting journey over again, what would be the piece of advice that you would give yourself?
I would say the children are going to be what they're going to be. No matter what you try, no matter what you say, that we try very hard to keep our children, well, safe, which is okay. But I would say, and I think I was pretty good at this, establish a culture the way my dad with me did with me. All you can ask your children is, give me your best today. It may not be the same tomorrow, but I have seen parents heap on enormous expectations that made their kids crazy. I learned from that because I had a father who was so emotionally intelligent. Let your children be what they want to be. Don't tell them, be a doctor or an engineer. Don't tell them, I know what's best for you. Parents, don't. You don't get inside the head of your kid. You won't know because they're not telling you. So that is my advice. Let them be what they're going to be. Love them and support them. Be there to help them. But let them fall. Let them skin their knee. Let them fail. They become your children's best teachers.
One step at a time. Up the mountain. Don't worry about the summer. Just worry about this next step.
Worry about it is the most important.
Find a way to enjoy it along the way, right?
You'd like to think, take a stop, look at the sun, take some water, take another step. But in mountaineering, as in life, we're one step away from getting run over by a car. We are. It happens all the time. We're one step away from falling off the mountain. We're one step away from drinking too much. We're one step away from getting behind the wheel of a car that we shouldn't. We're always a step away from opportunity or crisis. But here's the interesting part. The majority of the time, opportunity is waiting. But we get distracted. We get undisciplined. It's right there. It's right in front of you. Learn to drown out the distractions, the peer pressure, and the things that take you away from that next step. It's your step. It's not somebody else's step. You're the only one that can take it. Don't take it for someone else. Take it for you. Even as unpopular as it may seem, it's your step. Don't take it for someone else.
Chuck, you're the man. I appreciate you so much for making the time for this.
Oh, Jesse, it's a pleasure. Always wonderful to collaborate with you.
And everything you're doing. Where can people go check out your executive coaching, your speaking, your books, what you're doing at the university over there?
I appreciate it.
Where can they go?
I do, and I'm grateful for that. If you remember my name is Chuck Garcia. Pretty easy to spell. Garcia is my last name. If you go to chuckgarcia.com, there's a big contact button. All you got to do is hit the button, and you got me. It's so simple. Or on LinkedIn. I have Instagram, but you can always find me on LinkedIn as well.
All things Chuck. Easy to find.
ChuckGarcia.com, or if you Google me, bunch of stuff comes up.
Awesome, man. Well, thank you again, and we'll catch you on the next one, okay?
Jesse, it was such a pleasure. Thank you for the privilege of being able to collaborate with you on your show.